Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello.
And Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody.
Well, let's jump right in here, folks. Bryce, You said that you have questions. There apparently are people who listen to this.
Yeah. People send in questions to the email in the podcast notes. We got an email from Joe Diamond, who has written into the show multiple times.
Oh, good. As a matter of fact, I wanted to take a moment to thank Joe Diamond. Recently, we shot a bunch of Scam School episodes with him. If longtime listeners will remember, he was the one in the Chicago area who was looking to expand his presence there and had a venue at a haunted house where he was able to do his mentalism show. We gave some advice that he'd said some very nice things about. And it was awesome seeing him in person, hanging out and having him share his incredible talents on Scam School. Those episodes will be rolling out over the next few weeks.
Yeah. So we got an email from him. I will read it here. Hey guys, Joe Diamond again. Thank you for all the advice you gave me for the mentalism show I'm doing in a haunted mansion.
He's ripping me off, stealing my stuff. Those were my lines.
It's become the number one thing to do in my area, and every show has been sold out for all of 2018.
Holy cow.
I'm debating on developing a new show for those who come back to see me. Should I try something within the realm of spooky / fun mentalism, or should I use this as an excuse to try something different? I've been thinking of something more like a sideshow stunt / brain game type show with a human blockhead, memorizing a deck of cards in 15 seconds, etc. Escape rooms will usually have several different rooms, but they're all within some sort of brand. Should I keep sticking with the same type of show and wait until that dies down to start something new to regain public interest? Thanks, Joe Diamond.
Oh, wow. I actually have thoughts on this. And Andrew, do you want to jump in or can I share what I'm thinking?
Go for it. I think we're probably the same mind on it.
So here's what you have. When somebody sees so for variety entertainers, you often you work very, very hard to get very, very polished. Maybe it's a 5-minute act that you tour internationally with. Maybe it's a 30-minute stage show that you do at corporate and events. Maybe it's an hour-long thing you do at colleges. Whatever it is, you get very, very good at that 1 hour. And then you run into the question of like, well, what do I do after that? And the most – I don't mean this in a bad way, but the gut reaction, the obvious reaction is, well, let me just write another hour-long show. But that takes an astonishing amount of effort. And I've, for example, for me, once it became clear that I had a solid college show that I was touring colleges with, they were like, well, we want to bring you back, but we've already seen that one show. What else you got? So for me, I wrote Scam, Sasquatch, and the Supernatural, which I think, looking back on it, was accidentally a good play because it was something that was peripherally related to what they knew me as for the first time. You know, the first time is the bizarre magic show, fire eating escapes, mind reading, that kind of stuff. But this was different enough that, but still in the same wheelhouse. Honestly, the problem is, like, let's say that became perfect. Or let's say at this haunted house, you have the show right now, and then you're like, well, can I write a second show? Let's say you do write a second show, and it's thematically identical, and it's exactly perfect. Mm-hmm. Then you run into what I think of as the David Copperfield problem, which is, what do you do after that? Well, the answer is you write yet another hour-long show, and then another hour-long show, and then another hour-long show, and then that's you on a treadmill forever, forever, forever. It might be that what they like, yes, they like the magic, could be, it might be that they just like you. And the only way to find that out is to figure out if you can write a show that has what I think of as like a comedy engine or a content engine, something outside of you that relies on you and your talents and your ability to improvise and be interesting and tell stories and so on, but that it writes itself. The best type of show, I would imagine, would be the kind of show where you can do it once, somebody can say, that was great, I want to see it again. They can come back and see it again, and they'll get something different. This is what you're experiencing right now, Joe Diamond, is a big part of me realizing Well, in order to do that, I'd have to be good at improvising and coming up with stuff on the fly and all that stuff. And those aren't skills that I currently have. And that's why I started doing the BB Live Show, NSFW, Night Attack, and then and why I was so excited to join Weird Things, because what we do on the Weird Things podcast is we have a content engine that basically you plug in News of the Weird each week, and now that we've all figured out what the different moving pieces are, we spit out 90 minutes of fresh original content. I would strongly encourage you. You could just write another show, and you'll never regret having another hour of polished material, but it takes so long. It's like a rock tumbler to get that stuff polished. And then when you get it, it's diminishing returns. Cause let's say 100,000 people see your first show, and of them, 20,000 people want to come see your next show. Then those people, and you know, whereas if you could create an engine that keeps on turning, then you could get a familiar cast of characters who are excited to keep coming back to see what else you got. Musicians already have this. They have the talent called play music. And then they can, their content engine is, what songs do I like? Do I want to do a cover? Do I want to write a new song? Do I want to do whatever? And so people come back week after week after week because they know it'll be different, but also have the elements that they liked the first time. So I would strongly encourage you, rather than writing another similarly themed mentalism or magic show, see if there's not an engine that brings out the parts of you that they already liked, but is something that could continuously reshape itself. Is that anywhere close to what you were thinking, Andrew?
I would want to preface it with a couple questions, because like it really depends upon, I wanted to be clear on the venues, because if you're looking for, if he's saying I got this show in the mansion and I want to go do a show somewhere else in an escape room, I would say 100% give it a different title. 100% give that, do a different show in a different venue. You know, when I used to do cruise ships back when they were, you know, they had galley slaves, you know, with oars. The water.
Back on the Mayflower.
They wanted you to have like three shows. You know, they wanted you to have like two different evening shows and a 15-minute show. You'd add up, this is this show and it's called this, and this is this show, then it's called that. They wanted that. They wanted maybe one that was more audience participation than one more that was standalone. So it can be very, very venue specific. To your point, Brian, you know, it's interesting because like comparing, let's say, Penn and Teller and David Copperfield. Now, David Copperfield would do like the George Carlin would do, is he would, for about a good solid 15 years, half the show was new every 12 months, which was an insane amount of material to try to create and try to do. But we know who David Copperfield is today because he did that. Like George Carlin would write half the show every year. David was spending the amount of money David spent on magic doing that. But that's why David's show kept getting better. And he got better at making things better. He may have had names for the show, but it was really just David Copperfield. Now, Penn and Teller would do a tour-based model. They would do the refrigerator tour. They would do this sort of tour. And it would be a lot of the same elements from the previous show, but then some new elements or some new tricks or whatever like that. And so they would do, like, this is the new. When David did Broadway, it was Nightmares and Dreams. There's usually every season he changed. I think there was probably a change in the name. But it was the same show evolving. For Joe, I would say, like, if you're saying, I want to do the magic show, the mentalism show over in the haunted house here, but I want to go across the street or downtown – to over here at a escape rooms. All right, I wasn't trying to figure out if he was saying using it as an example or.
Well, yeah, I think that's an example.
Yeah, when he came down, one of the things he talked about was how thankful he was for your advice of looking into escape rooms because they're so hot right now, and that's a venue that many mentalists and performers wouldn't have normally thought to reach out to.
Yeah, so if it's too, I think, keep the creepy mentalism one in the haunted house, but I think then in the escape room stuff, and you can give it a different, if you're like, oh, I've got an audience from last year, well, change that show, add some new stuff to it, even take stuff maybe you like out, put something new into it. Creating a new show, as Brian says, is hard, but it's the best thing you can do as an entertainer is to push yourself to create new material, because the problem happens is I've seen this time and time again. Somebody spends a lot of time, they come up with a really good, tight hour show, and they get a lot of work. They get a lot of work. People are like, we love it, we love it, we love it. And they're like, great. They tweak it. They keep it kind of relatively the same. Maybe they add a new trick or two, but they don't really put the same amount of energy they did into making that first show. Year goes by, 2 years go by, 3 years go by. They're getting booking, but they're getting a few less bookings. Year four goes by, they're getting a few less. Year five goes by, their show's not that hot anymore. But like the show works great with the audience, but the people who book it, and maybe it's a 20% difference really that it's hard to see as it's gradual over time, and they forgot how to create. They forgot how to be. Now all of a sudden they're like, I got to create a bunch of new stuff, and they try to create a bunch of new stuff in a short amount of time, and the strength of them as a performer helps it carry over, but the quality of the material is not that good because they waited forever to do that. So I would say absolutely for marketing and branding purposes, have a separate show. Absolutely try to figure out how you can put material in there. As Brian says, it's hard to put a bunch of write an entirely new show. But man, if you can get it, if you can, magicians who think like comedians who are always working on new bits and new stuff and doing this do way better than magicians who stand still.
So what I guess what my advice was is figure out a way to dip into a well outside of magic, because
I was going to say, I was listening to your advice and I wasn't sure what that looked like for someone who wanted to be doing magic.
Well, and what I'll tell you what it looked like for me. Like I wrote 2 to 3 new routines every year I toured colleges up until I started doing Scam School. And then all of that creative bandwidth got eaten up by Scam School. And on the one hand, I felt like, oh no, I'm under delivering or whatever. But then on the flip side, you could say, no. Instead of going from writing 10 minutes of new material every year and testing it out and polishing it while you're on the road, you're suddenly writing 5 minutes of new material every single week you're writing 250 new minutes of material. And so likewise, and that's certainly me doing magic, right? And well,
it was me in books. That was like, I could, I'll apply that creativity that was writing magic books to writing thrillers and mysteries and say, let me go do that. They'd be like, why did you write magic books? And it's like writing novels. You know, it's that. Now, I will tell you another option is, and I think Brian, you've experienced this to a degree, and a performer who I think I've watched grow and I think is phenomenal and his routines are brilliant is Justin Willman.
Oh, right? Absolutely.
And watching Willman started off like a lot of other college entertainers. He's a very funny, likable guy, but the material was sort of very much very similar. And then as Justin started doing, more TV, starting Tonight Show stuff, Justin appreciated the value of a brain trust. And so Justin works with a group of magicians who come in there and help him figure stuff out. And he's picking out comedic bits, whatever. The last time I saw his show, he got me a couple times. I'm like, man, like I did not see that coming, and it's great and it's wonderful. And what I would say, Joe, think about this. Who are some of the smartest people you know in Chicago? Who are some of the smartest people you know there? Maybe not magicians, but people get entertainment, movies, pop culture. Sit down and think up stuff with them. You know, have a little brain trust there. And even when you're feeling a little creatively spent, you'd be amazed at what that does.
Yeah. And keep in mind also, there's I forget where I read this from, but there's three types of talent. There's unproven talent, proven talent, and emerging talent. You very likely the obvious response is like, well, Justin Willman can afford to pay all this proven talent. He's like, yeah, because he's playing a different game. He's playing a more mature business model that's farther along. And of course, you don't want to trust the quality of your show to unproven talent, although that could be worth finding some people right out of college who are learning magic or whatever. Have those conversations. Maybe only 1 out of 20 times they'll have a brilliant idea, but sooner or later they'll have a brilliant idea. But my guess is whether it's at the local magic club, whether it's from the audiences of the people who show up, you might be able to spot some emerging talent, some people that you could give $50, say like, hey man, can we just sit down? I'll give you $50. Let's just brainstorm some stuff. And all of a sudden you've got real talent and real ideas, but it fits your budget.
I would say even stay. I mean, unless you know somebody who's a really, really all on board gets it, I'd even stay away from magicians. You know,
I agree.
Because like some of the best ideas I've ever had are from people who get theater and get entertainment. And, you know, because, you know, the problem, like, so I'm like, I have a brain trust, a bunch of magicians like Gary, they're going to tell you what the latest thing on sale at Penguin Magic was. You know,
if you go to Comedy Sports and you meet some of the young talent that's getting ready to, you know, in the improv community, or if you go to, you know, some of the touring folks at the local comedy club, or talk to a musician, like get somebody totally out of your realm. And then the answer might be, oh, wait, this is on Tuesday nights. I'm not doing anything on Tuesday nights. What if you had spooky accompaniment with a theremin, because I've been working on the theremin? These organic kind of out of nowhere things, like that's what happens when you step outside your discipline and start talking to other people.
100%.
Well, Joe, cool. You're welcome.
Yeah.
Any other questions there, Bryce?
No, that'll do it for questions today. So back to his idea of doing a, cause it sounded like his idea for a new show it's going to be, you know, a sideshow or a brain game sort of show. Like,
which, by the way, is like if he does it, that's good scaffolding, because that's something that you could come up with a framework. You could come up with the backstory. You could come up with some of the structural bits. It can always begin with 15 minutes of magic and mentalism. And then it's got modules that you can plug in and out. And those modules can be, you know, a library of 100 to 200, you know, as long, like, for example, here's the difference. If you write the material such that it has to be these tricks in this order, then you are really, really locked in. But if you say, okay, no, I do 15 minutes of opening mentalism, and then there are 7 5-minute puzzles, and then you can lock down in the abstract, what do each of these modules look like? Well, they always begin with some kind of tale that involves a couple of elements of improv. I involve, you know, names for the, you know, whatever the characters are in this locked room mystery. I make sure they're the names of these people and somebody they hate, somebody they love, and 3 celebrities, right? That's something that you can write in the abstract and make up on the fly. But then, and they're like, and then there's a twist, and always Voltron shows up at the end. Whatever these things are, then you now have storytelling elements in the abstract that can be applied and constantly reskinned so that somebody can enjoy. Now you could do that for any puzzle. So it's like the first puzzle is always a sci-fi theme. Second one is always a fantasy theme. Third one is a dark, spooky monster theme or whatever. Now, it doesn't matter what the puzzles are. You have an algorithm that you can run on the fly live for them. And it, essentially, you get an unending content engine that can go forever and ever and ever.
It's great advice from somebody who has been through this and done this over and over again. And I think that, Joe, your instincts on these things is often very, very on point in what you want to do. And so we're going to just start asking you questions. You know, What we love about Joe, to our other listeners, stuff that we love about Joe is Joe's out there doing stuff. Joe's out there doing stuff. And it is a frustrating thing when somebody says, hey, I want some advice. And you sit down and you spend an hour, 2 hours giving somebody advice.
And they say, well, yeah, but.
Yeah. And regardless if they follow what you did, and then a year later, how's it going? Yeah, I've been thinking about it or this or what. Like, I want to write a book. Are you going to write? Oh, yeah. And then a year later, like, did you do it? No. Because like, was it really ever important to you? Was it really ever important to you?
There's no more toxic phrase than, well, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it right. That is blatant cowardice. It is the shield behind which so many talented professionals have hidden. And the tragedy is so much of what might have been never occurs. Yeah. And we've talked about this before, but success is built on failure. If there's any one gift I could give to the world is be bad fearlessly and exceptionally and learn lessons from it.
I am a very and we're all very, very lucky people here. We're all very, very, very lucky people. And part of the reason we're lucky is that we put ourselves in the path of opportunity. You know, we made phone calls, we took risks, we did things to go out there to do stuff way beyond our capabilities, way beyond maybe what we're ready for, but we're willing to go do this. I'm excited about what's going to be, you know, airing because, like, you know, I went way outside my comfort zone at a point at which it's stupid to do it.
Quick side jag, Andrew. This will be, your third or fourth successful television project? That must mean you only made 3 or 4 pitches, right? Because each one hit.
Pretty much. Yeah. I would say that my success rate for my on-camera stuff, though, since after I did the Don't Trust Andrew Main show, has been 100%. This is the first and only thing that I pitched
really?
On camera. Yeah, this was the only thing. I didn't because I'm like, I knew if I was going to do something, I had to do something very different. I didn't want to do what I did before. This is sort of funny. Was it like, I got a prop here, if I conveniently, literally when I got this thing green lit, like the next day, I got the Edgar nomination certificate, you know,
amazing.
And I'm like, why am I doing this at my point in life?
But what a wonderful situation to be in, man.
Oh, awesome. I mean, I was, there'll be more details that there are even points where like, I may have been throwing up profusely from seasickness and stuff. And people are like, how are you feeling? I'm like, fantastic. This is the most amazing thing I've ever to do. And I'm a lucky guy to be able to do this sort of stuff. But that's because you can sit there. Like, Man, there was a version of me that was like, I'll write an email to somebody and ask if they want to do this, or I'll do this. I did the most minimal amount possible. I did minimal amount possible, and my results reflected that, okay? At some point, I said, I've got to risk being laughed at. I've got to risk having people tell me it's stupid. I've got to risk immense failure if I want to try to do step up. And then, you know, a funny thing happens. Eventually, things, you know, when I decided to start writing books, which is now 7 years ago, you know, I spent that first year writing 10 novels just so I could get that out of me. And then things start to click and click and click and click and click and click. And then now I'm at this point where I'm like, man, I wasted half my life. I wasted half my life because I was too shy, too timid, too maybe it's not me to go do stuff. And I'm like, man, if I'd been ahead of the curve 10 years ago, 5 years, or even a year before, you know, and that's my advice to you guys out there is like, you know, Joe's out there doing stuff. Go do something. Just do it.
Yeah, I think of it as painting in negative space where there are two ways to draw something. You could draw what you think the thing is, or you can fill in with black everything that's not the thing and then discover what it is at the end. And I think that, you know, I didn't know that I was an internet person. I thought, you know, I was like, oh, no, I'm going to be a magician. I'm going to follow the model of these people. And instead, I painted in black stuff that I'm like, no, I'm not good at that. Oh, no, I can't do that either. Oh, I tried that. It failed pretty spectacularly. And then you look at what's left. You're like, huh, I guess I'm pretty good at being on the internet. And telling stories, showing up and doing YouTube videos.
The internet can't get rid of you. there's one of the things that I saw early on was observing some people around me who had big aspirations, who were doing stuff, was the first big failure they had. They're like, fate has decided this is not for me. They decided that somewhere that, you know, God or whatever, no, you shall not pass. And they stopped. I've seen that with so many entertainers and people like, I tried, I got this close, and then it happened. I'm like, did you think that like you're magic and special and that like it was supposed to be easy, that you only had to go up to bat once and have it succeed? And I've encountered this a lot. People are like, I tried. Okay, one, maybe you did something stupid, or more likely just the odds weren't, you know, like I've had the number of times that I pitched or did, you know, pilots for TV shows before I got on air. I did a number of them before they ever got on air. I never told anybody about it. And we never hear about that part of success is you hear, oh, so-and-so, they're great on the show. They're great on, you know, Westworld. Like, yeah, you know, that person for 7 years auditioned for starring roles and said, they got said, nope. Okay. Finally, they got through. And that is the reality of it, is that most of these things, and whether you're pitching something, creating a business or doing anything, it's persistence. You know, there's this, we talked about before, there's a backlash against Elon Musk because, like, you know, you hear Elon Musk's name everywhere, right? And, you know, and part of it is this, you know, he seems like this very lucky guy to some people or whatever, but he's also a guy that once he amassed a lot of money and people become the most risk averse ever, they become super, super risk averse, they're not going to risk their money, he went the opposite direction. He put everything on the line between two companies, personally, professionally, health-wise, put everything into those things. And then he shows you what there could be a lot more people like them if you reach that point, you were more, less likely to be risk averse, whatever. And that's the thing, is if you're risk averse and you have nothing to lose, you're not going to gain anything. But if you're willing to say, hey,
well, and think about what an insane play that was, not only to make the decision to move into a highly risky number of ventures, a whole bunch of risky ventures, mm-hmm. but also to make the decision of like, well, if I wear my failures on my sleeve, if I make that part of my personal brand, then on the other side, I become impervious to it. So it's like, yeah, go ahead. Think of me as the guy who's constantly posting on my Instagram, failed rockets blowing up. Great. Don't mind it at all. If you can be that person, then that's the only way to get through any kind of statistical improbability.
Yeah. I mean, it comes down to a numbers game. So try. Don't be afraid to be bold. Experiment. Be analytical. Be self-critical. That's the hardest point of anything. When I first started writing stuff, it was very hard for me to take criticism of what I was doing. But once I got to the point where people liked it, I could say, okay, not everybody will like it, but most people tend to. I'm fine with that. And then once you get to that point, the other side of it, then it becomes easier. But a lot of times people stop because either they can't handle failure or they can't handle criticism. But if you say, hey, this is more important than else, then you'd be amazed. It may not land exactly where you want, but you're going to land somewhere that's better than where you are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, so. You got I got a pick.
Go for it.
Yeah.
I just wrapped up like 3 hours ago a book by, he was the author of Yes Man, Danny something, starts with a W. But the book is called F You Very Much. It's F dash dash dash. But it's about politeness and rudeness in the modern age. And the whole book got kicked off because he ordered a hot dog. And they, Danny Wallace, that's the guy's name. He ordered a hot dog and it took over an hour to receive. And he found himself fighting with the, presumably the owner of the establishment about how he was rude because he didn't know how it worked. And he thought she was rude because it shouldn't take more than a freaking hour to get a hot dog. So he ends up commissioning a nationwide survey from whatever the English equivalent of the Gallup group is, and he calls it the Wallace Report, and has a number of different questions he explores with a bunch of people, like, why do people act rude, and more importantly, why do, when faced with rudeness, people feel like they're entitled to be rude in return. One of the questions he asks is, he asked people in the Wallace Report, what have you done in revenge to somebody who's been rude for you, or rude to you? And he gives a bunch of examples. He says, now, I'm going to list to you what they have said that they've done, but I'm going to skip the part where, imagine these confessions, if they weren't prefaced with, somebody was really rude to me, so I, dot, dot, dot. Mm-hmm. Imagine that's not there. And instead, it's just a list of confessions. I spat in someone's food. I stole their whatever. I had sex with their significant other. I did this. I did that. Like, we forgive these obviously sociopathic, insane, terribly rude actions in our minds if they are the results of an injustice of someone having been rude to them. It was fascinating. I really, really enjoyed it.
Disturbing.
It really is.
I've been going back and I just finished watching this maybe a month or so ago because the last season was on Netflix, and it, like, watching that last season made me want to go and restart watching it because it's not very long. It's AMC's Halt and Catch Fire. Did you get to see any of that, Andrew?
I haven't watched the final season, but I've watched all the other ones.
It's pretty good. I know, Brian, you were saying it was on your list to watch, but you hadn't
seen it. I watched the first two or three, maybe four episodes.
Okay.
And it seemed I loved the very beginning of it. But yeah. I was afraid of diving all the way in for fear of it getting mushy in the middle. But it keeps rocking hard.
It does, because every season it finds various reasons to reset things and skip time, mm-hmm. various amounts. And it basically follows these four people. As they start out in the what did they call it? The Silicon, not Valley. The Silicon, basically the Texas Silicon Valley in the 80s.
Oh, sure, sure. The Silicon Hills.
Is that it? Yeah.
Well, that's. I mean, if it's in Central Texas, you know, Intel is here, so, Dell, and all that stuff.
Yeah, and basically follows as these four people come together to commit a felony, and it follows sort of the rest of their lives over, you know, over a decade or so. Silicon Prairie, PB Bunk says, maybe that's what they used in the show. It's interesting. I watch it and I like, there's something about the concept of like rehashing history from a fictional entity, mm-hmm. you know, like, I think that's kind of why I ended up watching all of The Newsroom, Aaron Sorkin's The Newsroom, because it can be a little grandstandy to be like, well, here's how I would have handled, you know, the news of Osama bin Laden dying or whatever. But it's still interesting to see it emerged like this, like, oh, these people just casually invented broadband internet and you know, online gaming and stuff. But there's something about it, and I think the characters are really interesting and are all have depth to them. So I like it, and it's only four seasons on Netflix, so you can probably get through it reasonably quickly. That's a Halt and Catch Fire from AMC.
Nice.
Yeah, I enjoy it. They took a number of stories from, you know, the birth of the computer age, like the creation of the clones and stuff like this, and then rechanged the names and stuff and kind of put this one group of people in the center with kind of Steve Jobs-like figure who then becomes not Jobs, whatever. And I enjoy it because what's nice is you go, oh, that was a thing that happened, but kind of not quite like this, but let's go see what happened there. So I enjoy it. I haven't watched the second one yet. I mean, the last season, but
the last season is pretty good because they wrap it up because I think they knew that was their final season. So
yeah, and I was amazed they covered as much as they did from like the birth of the PC to the rise, you know, to the online, to the internet and all that, which is kind of a neat way to sort of tell that story. So it's good. My pick, and I mentioned this before in our weird things, and this is actually gonna be my pick here, is man, we live in a golden age for so many reasons. Besides the fact there's such amazing content out there, it's so easy to learn stuff. It is so easy to learn things now. It is. I've mentioned this before. Every birthday, I like to take some time and learn something. You know, 2 years ago was I learned how to program Ruby and Rails, and I made my author page website for other authors, a free site for authors to create websites with. Last year, I worked on some stuff, including I made Story Voice, which is a voice dictation thing, which does intelligent voice dictation by learning Swift. And then this year, I decided to dive deep into Python because I want to get a lot more into machine learning, object recognition and stuff for some stuff. I've been playing a little bit with that. I said, no, let me just actually do a Python boot camp, like a 30-hour course, and then get into some other stuff. The beautiful thing is it is – one, if you have a library card in the United States, most library systems participate in lynda.com, lynda.com. It's free. You can get free courses there. Then you have courses. You have groups like Udemy, right? U-D-E-M-Y. Udemy is offering a $10 sale on thousands of courses. I bought about a half dozen. I was like, oh, should I do this course? But I need to do this one before. I'm like, it's $10. Yeah, you know, yeah. I'm in the middle of a 30-hour Python course with quizzes and interactive tutorials and stuff, and it's I paid $10 for this thing, and you know, I've already got, you know, a lot more. So it has never been easier to learn. I'm surprised more people don't do it.
And the way Udemy does, because Lynda makes all of their own courses, I believe, or they're all like packaged in a certain way, where Udemy is people go and make it themselves and sell it. So if you find someone on Udemy that you like, you can kind of know, okay, well, I like this person who taught me Python. Maybe I'll go check out his thing on Ruby or what have you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. Like I get this sort of fatigue at some point because people are like, oh, I'd like to learn this, or like, why don't you? Like, meh, you know, like, oh, by the way, I watched, you know, the last two seasons of Arrow. I'm like, and like in my head, I do the math. I'm like, man, you could pick up an entirely new, if you're skill deficient. Not everybody's skill deficient. You know, you're skill deficient if you don't have job. If you're looking for opportunities or occupations or things like this, and you don't have skills that are value. Not to say you're not doing a value as a person, but you know, I have a friend whose father's a typewriter repairman.
Right.
He's not employed. He's not gainfully employed because he's a typewriter repairman, you know. And it's hard to adapt. It can be. It's very hard mentally taxing to do this stuff. But it is so cheap now. Like, feel like, ah, to go to college stuff. I have had job offers from conversations, people who had no idea what I did. No idea what I did. But I'm in a tech place or whatever like this. And I'm talking about, you know, something like, oh, yeah, I was doing this, playing around this bit of code, doing this. Like, oh, cool. What do you think about this? Like, da-da-da. Like, you know, we're hiring. I'm like, oh, whoa, I don't really have, I'm just a, no, you, and I've had this happen multiple times because I take these courses, I get into it, dig deep, and then, you know, opportunities are out there. So it's cheap. It's cheap, folks. There's no excuse. It's time.
I mean, it's expensive in your time, but but cheap in money. Like, money is no longer a viable excuse.
Yeah, and I've studied the average person, and I look at the amount of average hours they spend in social media and other stuff, and I would say that more people often have – some people there are
– Andrew, we've talked about this. I'm building a brand. It's important so that people relate to me.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Yeah. And so that's my I gave Bryce like a hard time, and it was not me intentionally the other time because Bryce.
I was thinking about like last week when you're like, oh, well, 90 hours, I could write a book.
But yeah, because Bryce talking about watch this, and because like I'm like, I could write it. That's how long it takes me to write a novel. And I'm like, that's the math I do. It's people like, hey, you should check out this new show. I'm like, I have a certain amount of time that I have unwind brain time that I'm like, I don't want to do something. I need to take my brain away. But it's a small block of time kind of at the end of the day kind of thing. But man, I mean, what a time to be alive. I'm just saying, what a time to be alive. The amount of technologies and capabilities, things that are out there for people, and all the skills, things. It doesn't have to be computer programming. It can be graphic design. There's tons of stuff, but all sorts of amazing things out there. Udemy, lynda.com, whatever. There's other places. There's so many resources out there. Don't be intimidated by it.
And I'll go to bat for Udemy. I've bought a course or two from them on like music stuff. And it's a good system that they've got. You know, I was able to, you know, I knew I had a flight coming up, so I went and I bought some courses and I was able to save them for offline viewing.
Oh, I thought you were about to say like, just in case I want to learn how to fly the plane. So if they had a heart attack, I was ready to go.
No, but I was able to, I could save anything for offline, and they have chapter, you know, it'll follow you where you are in chapters of different courses. So, you know, it's a good system for being a sort of marketplace sort of structure.
You know, in this day and age, you want to have multiple skills. You know, Jeff Bezos was a finance guy who understands computers and then got into logistics. You know, Elon Musk, engineer, worked on electric cars, then got into computers and then got into rocketry, picked this sort of stuff. Think of film directors. You know, think of, you know, Ryan Coogler. Okay, this is a guy, I guarantee you, he not only knows how to direct, he probably knows his way around Adobe Premiere and After Effects enough to get things done. He knows his way around writing. He knows his things around other stuff. You know, I think that, you know, John Krasinski, okay, you know, directed, you know, A Quiet Place, right? I guarantee you it wasn't like he just one day like, well, enough of actor man stuff. What is his directing thing? This is a guy that you probably...
And my guess is Jim from the first season of The Office could not have directed A Quiet Place. Think about how much learning happened between then and now.
Yeah, which meant that he was reading the same books other people do on screenwriting and storytelling and stuff and breaking things down. He picked up multiple skills and he went from, hey, I know this guy, for he's in movies, he's an actor. I've met a number of actors, by the way, who are like that, because acting's part of their time and then they're spending other time either getting into real estate or doing other businesses and stuff like this. So you can stack there's a conversation we've had. I think we talked about this before, like, you know, the 10,000 hours versus the 100 hours. Talked about this, Brian?
I don't think we talked about this distinction. Walk me through this.
Well, I the idea that it takes 10,000 hours to be great at something, I do think there is something to this. You want your pilot, you know, the pilot flying your airplane to probably spend 10,000 hours doing this, right? You know, if you want to be Jimmy Page, 10,000 hours or so, and being Jimmy Page is helpful. But if you want to get on stage and play bass with Kiss, 100 hours, probably good enough. 100 hours will get you to that 99% level, that 90% level. Magic. You give me 100 hours to teach you how, as my buddy Jordan Gold, we talked about this. 100 hours of somebody who's a dedicated learner, I could put you on stage as a magician at the Magic Castle and have people think that you've been doing it for years.
Yeah, I think that's an important distinction, is the 10,000 hours is a it's not even a prescription. It's just an observation of those who are truly extraordinary and exceptional and at the very top of their class of whatever their art is. Then there's such there's B+. There's like good enough. Had a great time. You did magic really good. And I think we're seeing that, for example, friend of the show, Matt Donnelly, he is an improv comedian who was dared by Pendulette, like, hey, quit pretending to, you know, do sketches about magic. Why don't you just learn some magic? Maybe I think he's not even yet at 100 hours of onstage time doing magic, but he is on tour opening for Piff the Magic Dragon nationwide. And he's good enough because he has chops and comedy and all that stuff, and he's telling a story, and he's getting pretty great at magic. Also, his drawing duplication is extraordinary. I highly recommend you check out his show. And that's not just because it's mine.
And like, think about actors or musicians that you know that are in the mainstream. How many of them started off great? Like even in the mainstream, right? It probably got better first, but before, you know, whether you think someone might be on a decline, they don't start off at the peak, right? I would say very few people start off at their peak.
Yes,
you know.
So my thesis is that 100 hours of intelligent study is enough to get you going and into it. Get you into the game. 100 hours of intelligence, and it's not a real rule, but it's the idea that oh, if I want to be a great actor, I got to spend 10,000 hours. Well, you know, maybe, but that's if you want to be the 99th percentile. But if you want to be the 95th percentile, which to most people looks like the 99th percentile, and then have the time to go do it, 100 hours of dedicated in a lot of things. Some things are harder than others, like foreign languages and stuff can be hard. But 100 hours of dedicated foreign language search of studying, you'll be able to get by. You know, you'll be able to get by. You know, you're not going to be proficient, you know, but you're, you know. So anyhow, that's my 100-hour thesis.
That's good. I like it.
So anyhow, gentlemen, it's been after.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.